Man, it's hot down here in Outlandish Parish. And while the heat breaks every part of your mind and your soul and your body and definitely your backyard, that ain't the worst part of the summer. The summer's knowing that those days that bring relief, that bring the clouds, that bring the rain, those are a mixed blessing. Because though summertime is definitely the season of the ditch, it's also hurricane season down here in Outlandish Parish. Welcome to Outlandish Parish. You've got me and Jonas back with you.
Hi.
And this week, we're going to be talking about hurricanes, the big bad of the summertime storms along the entire Gulf Coast and the Eastern Seaboard as well. They're so definitive for our entire way of life down here. Like, really, it's why you put up your storm shutters. It's the reason we all own a deep freeze. You know, it's
the reason we hopefully own a generator, too.
I miss the quiet of pre-everybody having a generator post-hurricane.
Yeah.
I like
oh,
my
I
air
bet.
Conditioning.
Yeah.
But one of the things, I mean, not that we had a huge number of storms when we were little, but, you know, there were a couple of times whenever you'd lose power, I used to love, because that happened a lot, whether it was for a hurricane or not.
Right. Or just, yeah, exactly. Living down the bayou. Yeah.
I mean, you guys probably had that too. Like the power would go out, not for every time a hurricane, just because the wind blew too hard and it'd be quiet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It'd be like extra quiet. Like even that hum that you don't realize is there until all the power goes out was gone.
Yeah, that's true.
And I kind of like that. Now when the power goes out, all you hear is, M-m-m-m-m-m. It sounds like you're in a boat race.
No, you're right. You know, I didn't really consider that. To be fair, I wasn't there for Ida like y'all were. So I was in the north, as I have lived for the last 7 years, for those of you who don't know. Anyway, I've lived through a few. Yeah.
Even with how constant our awareness of the hurricanes are, like, I didn't know where the name came from. You know me, I always start with the words.
Mm-hmm. Etymology.
Etymology is so much fun.
I love it too, actually.
When I started doing my research, I'm like, okay, so where does the word hurricane come from? En français, right? I've been working on my French with my table français. Mm-hmm. C'est comme un ouragan, right? And it's close,
okay.
But that's,
yeah.
It sounds like it could be a food, right? So way back in the day when the Spanish were first and the Portuguese were first exploring the Western world, the people that lived in the Caribbean were called the Taino. I'm probably pronouncing that completely wrong, but it's T-A-I-N-O. So you're talking about people that lived there up until the colonization, and the colonization was not great. They were at first made into these exotic creatures by the Western people and then exploited, and then eventually the genocide that came with European occupation. So that's a big monolithic clump of information that is covered in other places, and if you want to learn more about it, I definitely will have links. But the Taino people, their concept of the hurricane, of this destructive force, it was a god. It comes from the stories of Huracan, and this is a god that had some cross-pollination in the way that religions can with Mayan civilization and a lot of the deity structures of Central America. So to them, the Huracan was part of their creation myth. It was that fundamental, right? So the hurricanes have always defined existence in this part of the world. And according to the Taino mythology that I was able to find, this is one aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Atabe, she was their creation goddess, and she created the earth, the sky, the firmament, all the stars in the heavens. And as a continuation of that work, she bore two sons, Yukaju and Guakar. And from here, it's like that twin brother jealousy story that Christians have in Cain and Abel that a lot of mythologies have. And Yukaju makes the sun and the moon, and Guakar gets like really jealous because he's made the sun and the moon and they're so beautiful. And so he renames himself Juakar, and he just destroys the world. Basically, Yukaju made such beautiful things when he made the sun and the moon that Guokar was like, well, screw you. I'm just going to break all your And right, so yeah. he destroys the world with wind and water. And so from Juokar, you get Hurakar, and then Spanish, Hurake, and then eventually you get to Hurricane in English and Oraguin in French. So it's a god, right? This is as important to the Taino mythology as Cain and Abel are to Christianity, right? That's the hurricane to these people. And it feels like it's still that way today, like that much gravity. You know, when you look at the indigenous people that lived here in Louisiana, I'm sure in Florida and other places, they had mythology as well that involved the hurricane coming in and devastating everything. But you see it throughout like the entire colonial period as these European settlers and colonizers come in. Part of the reason that they were able to settle in certain coastal areas in their minds so easily was because the indigenous people had learned to live with hurricanes in a way that let them know to get the hell out.
You know? Yeah, what is it? I wonder how that evacuation process, I mean, not evacuation process, because they probably don't have much of a, you know, forewarning of the hurricane coming, but like, what did they do? Just
they tie themselves to the oak trees.
Yeah.
There are stories up and down the eastern seaboard. I mean, you look at the, especially here with the Homa and the Chitimacha, their houses were kind of made as impermanent structures, right? When they came down to the extreme coast, when they came down to Chauvin and Cocodrie and Grand Isle and the end of La Fouche de Chitimacha, what is now Fouchon and that entire coastal area, they had settlements, but the larger settlements were always further inland. They would come down here seasonally to hunt and fish, but for the most part, the places that stayed long enough to be really dug in were always further inland.
Which, of course, they were smart to do so because, you know, the impermanence of the that a hurricane presents, I guess, right?
Yeah, and I always think about it like in Japan, you have to imagine what it's like being in a place like Japan that's an island nation that's subject to not just tsunamis, but also typhoons, which is a Pacific hurricane. I think there's a reason their walls are made out of paper. It's like, well, that's done. Let's put the wall back up, you know, and it's a little bit easier than plywood and drywall. So there are people that lived here on settlements, but it was just kind of expected that they were going to have to rebuild and quickly, you know, mud huts with palmetto roofs and things like that that were in the environment that could be rebuilt rather quickly if something really devastating came through. But for their personal survival, I've heard anecdotal stories my whole life that I always thought were kind of like pawpaw. Honestly.
The stories of what exactly? The
oh, structure? Like tying yourself to the oak trees.
Oh, tying yourself to the oak trees. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you have to. I mean, what else would you do? Dig a hole in the ground? I mean,
I don't know.
You know, because like we said, the structures just weren't made for withstanding that kind of force from the wind, right? Or water, or whatever they're going to face.
I think our current predicament in both of our home parishes is proof that you can't prepare for it fully.
Right.
That it's just not possible.
Even today, right? Like knowing ahead of time and having the ability to make structures that could somewhat withstand the forces of nature, right?
It seems like, you know, through the colonization period, we see a lot of people trying to build homes that survive and trying to adapt to this local environment. But it really just reaches a point where the colonizers are kind of, they develop a hurricane party. It's like, oh yeah, this is one of these big hurricanes we get down here. And like surviving a hurricane got to be a rite of passage. They make fun of us for our hurricane parties. But that's kind of where they started, was people just living through it and making the best of it. And I cannot imagine not having the warnings that we have and having to trust your local wisdom to tell you what's coming from a storm. Because at least now, you know, we have this, oh, up to the second, like we would have never known Beryl existed. The hurricane that recently went through the Caribbean and over the Yucatan and just was, what, a Category 5 in June?
Yeah, and then hit Texas.
Yeah, it went up in Texas, and there was a lot of flooding. I think there were some deaths in Jamaica, but, you know, we wouldn't have known. If there wasn't a news channel, we got some, it's been rainy. But, you know, it's been rainy, it's been thunderstormy, but we don't have any signs that there's, you know, this huge storm going south of us the way that, you know, they have now with the National Weather Service. I mean, really imagine what it would have been like to just not know. I think it's going to rain. And the next thing you know, your neighbor's house is blowing away.
Wow. Yeah. No, Joe. Like, maybe you feel the pressure drop a little bit if you're that sensitive. I don't know. But do you even know what that means if you're feeling that, right?
So the first story of a huge and devastating hurricane that is still kind of present in local culture in Lafourche Parish was the Chenier Caminata hurricane of 1893.
I watched an interview with a survivor from that. He was like 4 years old when it happened, but it's on YouTube if anybody wants to check that out.
Yeah, we'll make sure we have a link for that. But yeah, 1893 was huge. If you know about the Gulf Coast, you might have heard of Grand Isle. It's directly mm-hmm. south of New Orleans. And there was a little settlement there that had about, you know, the estimates are about 1,600 people. And after the hurricane came through, there were 800 survivors.
Wow.
So that's half of the people were gone. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was just drowning from the storm surge. There were people who did the thing, right? They tied themselves to the trees. Yeah. But the storm surge was so high, they drowned.
I think there were only like, what, three surviving structures?
Yep, there were three surviving structures, and one of them was just this giant roof mm-hmm. that just so happened to land the right way. And like, I think a third of the people that survived under that roof.
Wow.
There were almost 100 people just stuck up under, and you can see pictures of it. It's just a big roof. But that hurricane, there was the centennial of it was when we were in high school. And so there was a lot that was memorialized about it in 1993 when it was the 100-year anniversary. Dr. John Doucet wrote a play about it that we attended when we were in middle school and high school. It's still a story that resonates through our culture. And it's interesting because one of the things that they included in that play was the signs that certain people, I think it was the local Tretas, was trying to warn them. She's like, "May look, Beb, the cows are laying down. Look at how the birds are flying." Because there was a cool front, right? This was late October. This was the end of hurricane season. This is when you stop really worrying about it. And there were people in the community that were trying to warn other people, like, "May Beb, a bad one's coming." And they just, it's going to rain. It's going to rain. And that was kind of one of the plots in the play, was that there were people that were like, "No, we need to batten down the hatches." And there were people that were disregarding it because of the time of year. And 779 people died at Chenier Caminata. And a lot of them were swept out to sea. Now, go ahead and check out the show notes, because there's been some amazing journalism on the Chenier Caminata hurricane. Not the least of which is this fantastic story by Margaret Baker from 1946 in the Jefferson Parish Memories. It looks like a little historical journal. I've got the PDF of it on the file. But her writing is just outstanding. But one of my favorite stories is the story of the bell. I'm going to be referencing an article written by Dr. John Doucet.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of gives a general overview, but he does talk about the story of the Caminata bell. There were stories about the bell from Father Ferdinand, Father Grimaud, who was the pastor of the Notre Dame de Lourdes Catholic Church in Chenier Caminata. If you're familiar with the name Notre Dame, Kate Chopin used it in her work as part of the setting. The bell's 700 pounds, and it's entirely made of silver. And supposedly some of that silver was some pirate treasure. These were the roughly grandchildren, maybe great-grandchildren, of the people who sailed with Lafitte, of those Barataria pirates. So the families of Grand Isle came together and they donated silver to make this 700-pound bell. And when you hear stories about this bell, you hear stories about the sound that it made, that it had a distinctive tone to it that sounded like a mother crying out and wailing.
Wow.
And Father Grimaud said that he could hear it all through the night as he was in the presbytery at Notre Dame. And there were accounts of people throughout the storm being able to hear the bell tolling in the night. And part of what made the storm horrible, that as it just got hit by wave after wave and all the devastation that was sweeping through Chenier, that it was almost worse when the bell went quiet. Because then on the morning of October 2nd, with the bell quiet, they knew that the church was gone.
Yeah.
You know, the aftermath, we don't talk about that very much, but the aftermath was almost as bad as the storm. They didn't have Highway 1.
all their food had been swept away. All their fresh water was gone. And if you've ever been on the coast right after a storm, there's a lot of muck that comes up, seaweed. So the people that did survive, they didn't have any fresh water. They had nothing to eat. And so those days after the storm were almost worse, and their church was gone. And their church bell was gone. And supposedly there's conflicting stories. Some people say the bell was never found on the island. There are some accounts that the bell was found on the island. But here's the weird part. In 1918, right, so the storm was in 1893. In 1918, they found the 700-pound silver bell, right? This isn't a dinner bell. This is a 700-pound silver bell buried in a cemetery in Westwego.
Oh, my God.
And since then, the bell has been returned to Grand Isle. I don't know that they ever figured out how the bell got from Grand Isle to Westwego, but they dug up the 700-pound silver bell, said, yep, that is the bell from Notre Dame and Father Grimaud from the 1893 hurricane. And it is now the bell for Our Lady of the Isle Catholic Church that is still standing in Grand Isle to this day.
You know, whenever we would go and visit the bell when I was little, my grandpa would tell me the story about C'est comme un miracle. It's a miracle. It's a miracle that the bell survived. And it's a miracle that they got it back when they did. You know, you talk about the fallout of the hurricanes. The hurricane at Señor Caminada changed my area because so many people moved inland. The area that's called Cut Off is not called Cut Off because of some stupid joke. It's where one canal intersected by Lafourche. It was the Cut Off.
Okay, yeah.
The old timers here started calling it Côte Blanche, the White Coast, because so many families from Chanière wound up moving up to this area, and they had lost everything, so they could only afford white paint. So before, you would paint the front of your house, usually something kind of bright and festive, but so many people had lost everything that all they could afford was like lime wash and white paint. So became a Côte Blanche, the White Coast, because all the houses from the people that moved up from Chanière were painted white. So you'll still hear some people considerably older. You heard it when we were younger, but you'll hear people call Cut Off Côte Blanche as opposed to Cut Off, because that's where the white houses all popped up after Chanière Caminada. The way hurricanes come up, they can be these huge storms that'll affect this giant radius, but they can also be, you know, fairly small. They can be more compact and still be devastating. And there will be storms that devastate our area, and Lake Charles has got a bright, shiny sky, and vice versa. You know, I mean, all a hurricane is really is a, it's a thunderstorm on steroids.
Right. That's rotating counterclockwise.
A Beyblade death of clouds. That's what it is. It's a little
yeah,
twisting top of horribleness.
Yeah. For 200 miles across or more.
Oh my God. It's ridiculous. Yeah,
it's wild.
But, you know, after Chanière Caminada, there were storms that came up and down. But the next one that we really heard about that really made the big news was Hurricane Hilda. Have you ever heard of Hilda, or were there any storms that, you know, affected?
Yeah, I've heard of Hilda, but I don't know too much about that one.
Well, I guess I'm asking, like, were there any storms that affected Chauvin, like that area, the lower Terrebonne between Chanière Caminada and...
I don't have any right here. I'm sure something has, but I don't have any in my notes. The first note I have is talking to Mom about Betsy in 65, but that's, you know, a little whiles off. Yeah.
Well, I mean, because Hilda and Betsy were kind of back to back. Hilda
well,
and Betsy.
What was Hilda, 27? So that, I mean, but that was...
No, 64.
Like 64. Okay. I didn't know Hilda was in 64. Okay.
There was a disaster in between that wasn't a hurricane. And that was the Great Flood of 1927.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that was the Mississippi River, though.
Yeah, that was the Mississippi River, but we didn't have what we think of now as like FEMA.
Yeah, there was no response at that time.
Well, there was for the Flood of 27. That was the thing. It was ridiculous. I mean, if you see the maps of this, it was 30 feet of flooding, 500 people died, 630,000 people were affected. And this is from Arkansas, Mississippi, and Louisiana, all throughout, you know, what we think of as the Atchafalaya Basin now. But that entire area, the federal government was in the boats trying to help people. It was so bad. But that was the beginning of the expectation of federal assistance. Like the Great Flood of 1927, for all that wasn't connected to any sort of hurricane, that was just a Mississippi flood. The levees breached in April. It just devastated the area in such a way that we wound up with Huey Long in part because of it, because this flood was so big, it helped raise them to prominence. But it also gave people this idea that there could be help. You know, there could be somebody coming to help out a little bit after something like that, after a natural disaster. And that was kind of what happened with Hurricane Hilda, because Hurricane Hilda, it was kind of like Ida in that it came up and it stayed. And it lingered, and it kind of curved and went up through more towards, I think it was New Iberia got it the worst.
Okay.
Every family down here owned like the Time Life article that had the coverage of Hurricane Hilda. And Hurricane Hilda hit October 5th, 1964. And then the next year is when we have our big bad, Betsy, in September of 65. Now, I know you have stories Betsy, because we all have stories about Betsy, because before Katrina, Betsy was the one that everybody talked about.
Yeah. But
Betsy hit in, September of 1965. My mom was 6 years old.
Let's see, 137 mile per hour winds, 81 fatalities, category 4. Yeah. Landfall date, September 9th, 1965.
Did your family evacuate?
They didn't evacuate too far. They went like up the bayou, my mom said. So did my dad. Let's see. My mom said it was one of the most terrifying times of her childhood, though. She was 7 years old at the time, and she told me that they were huddled in the living room, covered in blankets, and all she could remember is people saying the rosary. And, you know, for a kid, for anybody, that's got to be, like, completely terrifying. She remembers going outside, and it was calm, and there were two men standing there, and pretty sure one of them was her dad, Papa. She remembers them saying they were in the eye of the storm, and that it was calm, and then, like, then she remembers it hitting again, you know, after they got through the eye. They were in Upper Little Cayou as opposed to down the bayou. Which now, Upper Little Cayou, nobody would go there to evacuate a storm. With all the coastal erosion that's happened, like, there's no...
Give me a latitude. Upper Little Cayou, if you were to go dead east from there, where would you be hitting? La Rose, Galliano?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. Let me see. I'm going to need a...
Because my concept of Lower Terrebonne geography, my concept of all geography is pretty screwed, but...
So that's Galliano, about what I'm talking about.
Okay, got it. So y'all evacuated up the bayou to near Galliano. That's hilarious. Yeah,
they did anyway. At that time, you know, it was different. You know, there was more land at that time.
Yeah, but no, I'm looking at a map of the path, and that makes sense. That makes sense for y'all to have caught a little bit of the eye, and then for that of all to have hit. Where my mom and all were, because they were in La Rose for Hurricane Betsy. My mom said, "Mate, we never went north of the intracoastal before Katrina." She's very
just
proud
for
of
people
that.
To know, like, as the crow flies, that's like probably 20 miles away, Chauvin from Galliano, where my family was from hers.
It's not too far, but no, my papa was the principal of LCO at the time. It was LCO High School. And so he had to stay. That was the evacuation center. So people would evacuate to the schools. And my mom said, she said she was sleeping. They were all sleeping in some palettes, right? Just a pile of blankets on the floor in the gymnasium. And the storm came up, and it was, you know, a whole gymnasium full of people, like you see on cots and stuff, like you see on the news whenever they have evacuation centers. And she said, my mom will wake her up. She goes, you know, wake up, but don't move. Don't move. Stay where you are. Your whole back is full of glass. I need to get it off of you, but you need to wake up, because all the windows had blown in. Mom said she woke up because there was this boom, but my mama was already right next to her. And the windows, the pressure had dropped, and the windows had all sucked in and had shattered glass all over the evacuation center. So they had to move. They had to leave the gymnasium. I think they went to the auditorium after that, because there were no windows. So they wound up having to move. Well, my papa, during the eye, he went out to check on stuff, right, to see how bad it was, because he was in charge. And so he said, man, the eye wasn't big, so they must have just caught the very edge of it. If you're in the middle of the eye, it can last for a while. I think we went through the eye in Andrew. But if you're just on the edge of the eye, it can turn quick. Well, it turned quick because they were just on the edge. And my mama said, Papa, all of a sudden the wind kicked up. He was away from the auditorium. And the gravel started shooting off of the roof, the little plans, they call it. The plans were piquing him. The plans were hitting him really bad. You know, they used to put gravel on top of those flat roofs to help stop the tar from melting as much. So he picked up a sheet of plywood to protect himself from the gravel that was getting caught up in the wind. Well, the wind caught the plywood and pinned him against the building for hours. Mom said her daddy was missing in the hurricane for hours. And all my mom could do was sit there and cry and pray the rosary. She thought he was dead because he had gone out to check and he never came back. And come to find out, no, he was just stuck. My papa was, I mean, he was probably about the age we are now. He was in his mid-40s, maybe going towards 50, but my papa was a very big, strong man. And he could not push the plywood away from him enough to get away from the building.
Oh, wow.
Like, the winds were so strong, he stayed stuck up against the wall. Jeez. And the stories that you hear from Betsy are just out of the box around here. But my favorite stories from Betsy are from after the hurricane, because they get funnier. Because there's a certain amount of... that happens, because you have no power, you have no water. But you're still living in a place where you can eat. It's one of the reasons I will probably always try to have a gas stove as long as I can. Because the gas lines are fine, so you can still cook.
Usually.
You can still boil water. Usually. I mean, if it's really bad, the gas lines can go.
A la Katrina and Homa. That happened. Yeah. Just FYI. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
But yeah, a gas stove all the way.
Gas stove all the way. For non-political reasons, just for hurricane reasons. But it's stories about, I mean, my mom could sit here and probably tell us hours of stories about the weeks and weeks that they went without power after Betsy. But it was a family neighborhood, so they were all together. You know, they were all playing in the ditches together. There was no school. Mm-hmm. The school was decomposed, taking the pirogue to each other's houses for the flooding. And, you know, everybody working together to rebuild.
Yeah, the sense of community. That's what you have to have.
It was Betsy that wound up pushing for the Hurricane Relief Act of 1968, right? Betsy hit in September of 65, you know, because of the back-to-back devastation of Hilda and Betsy and, other storms that were outside of our area, was when the federal government was like, okay, we need to be able to help these people. So 1968 was when the Hurricane Relief Act was passed. But this was all before then, right? So this was, you had to rebuild yourself. House insurance, not really a thing. You just got together with your community and you rebuilt your community after a hurricane. One of my favorite, hilarious stories. My mama. Now, if you want to picture my mama, I don't know if I've said this before, but if you know Maxine from the Hallmark cards, the old lady with the dog who's kind of curmudgeonly.
Huh. Yeah.
My mama looked exactly like that. Like, if you, we gave her tons of Maxine stuff towards the end of her life because she just looked more and more like that lady. So just picture Maxine from the Hallmark cards, right?
Yeah.
No copyright infringement intended, just Maxine from the Hallmark cards. And my mama is always a very clean woman, and she wanted to take a frickin' bath. So she got a aluminum garbage can, right? Like the big old tall, probably about 55-gallon garbage cans, metal garbage cans like they used to have. She scrubbed it within an inch of her life, and she took water out of the bayou, boiled it to heat it up, and she was going to have her a bath. Well, she went to get in, and she fell. She fell croupion first, butt first, arms and legs in the air, into the bucket. It fell over, and she was stuck. So my mama was stuck butt first in the garbage can that she had spent hours preparing because she was tired of this and she needed a bath. She wanted to be clean. And my papa was laughing at her so hard that she wound up having to like crawl like a hermit crab on her side. My papa was too pomade to help her because she was just stuck ass first in the garbage can. Because that's what she was worried about. Was she was worried in all the devastation. She just wanted to have a bath. And like my mama was always so... I mean, she was a practical woman, but she was always very particular about, you know, how she presented herself. So the idea of Mama Ma stuck ass first in a garbage can, arms and legs in the air, crawling on the side, like trying to crawl on the grass, screaming for some help, help. When she fell over, all the water had fallen out that she'd spent like forever getting ready. It was hilarious. You know, stories about everybody coming together, stories about, you know, people going out and going fishing and bringing in food to feed everybody. You know, those are the stories about after Hurricane Betsy. And it's kind of similar for Camille. Camille hit in 1969. It didn't hit in Louisiana. It hit a little closer to Mississippi.
Mississippi, yeah, like Biloxi area.
Yeah, but we still got a lot of the devastating rain and everything. We still got a lot of devastation. And the thing with Hurricane Camille, it hit in August of 1969, but it was the first Category 5 storm. And because of where it hit, it also caused so much damage. But I think it was kind of like, well, Paul Betts, what happened in Lake Charles? Like, they were still recovering from Betsy. And so when Camille hit, it was like they weren't even completely back yet, you know?
Yeah.
The levees had been repaired and everything, but there were still some weak links. You know, they hadn't had time to test everything. But, like, I think something like 70,000 residents actually evacuated for Camille. But it went just east of the Birdfoot Delta, down near Burris and everything. It hit Cutoff. It hit Chenier. But we didn't get that direct impact the way they did with Betsy and the way they did with later storms. It hit 60 miles east of Orleans and Jefferson Parish was where the eye fell. So that would have been, Bay St. Louis, probably closer to the Mississippi line. But places like Tangipahoa, Plaquemine, and St. Tammany, St. Bernard, right, down the parish, like, they got it really, really bad. And their shrimping community, I don't know if you've ever been down to Burris, down that little...
I have, yeah.
So that area is a lot like Chauvin. It's just longer.
Yeah, it is longer. Yeah, I worked offshore for a little bit and back in the early 2000s, and yeah, we'd go down there.
So places like Slidell and Bogalusa, like, they got it really, really bad. Hundreds and hundreds of trees scattered, just this horrible devastation. And the stories for Camille, for me, it's kind of hard to tell the difference between Camille and Betsy because those stories kind of all get lumped together in our family lore.
It's also, like, you know, years, more than 12 years before either of us were born, so it's hard to put that in context.
What she was talking about, shut up, I'm talking to your aunt. Okay, fine.
Yeah, we listen. We try to get it right.
We try so hard. And then they make fun of us for getting the stories wrong. Did it hit Chenier terribly bad? Do y'all have stories about Camille, or is it just kind of the same thing? Like,
same thing, yeah. Not as bad. They remember it because it was a big deal in the local vicinity, but not like hyper local, I guess. And we're farther west than y'all, so
yeah, that's why I was curious if y'all, it was probably a similar impact. And then, like, the 70s, the hurricanes just kind of took off. Like, they just, like, were like, nah, we're good.
That's what I asked my mom and dad. I was like, what happened in the 70s? Any hurricanes? And they're like, no, not really.
But that plays into something, too, because the 70s, we were experiencing probably, I guess you would call it, like, this weird golden age of prosperity in Lafourche. What, we have more oil field infrastructure than y'all do.
No, there's quite a bit in Houma too. Yeah, y'all do have more, like, production. We just have kind of, like, tooling more so.
I'm talking specifically about, like, the places with the bayous in the front yard. Like, Houma has a lot of the business stuff, but, like, down in Chauvin, Cocodry and stuff, y'all don't have, like, down here we have, like, Motco, and I mean, you know, we don't have sidewalks, but we have some of those bigger businesses that built up, and those built up during the 70s. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, going down to Fouchon and all that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, there's a little more infrastructure with Fouchon being connected to Bayou Lafourche and with the shipbuilding industry that exists here with Bollinger and North American up in La Rose and Lockport. But a lot of those businesses were established. That's when you start seeing, like, money coming in. Like, we talked about that with our Mardi Gras episode, how, what was it, my mama said, nobody had time for that stuff before the oil field money came in, and that was all in the 70s and the 80s. That's what Suzanne told me. And that was when you see the oil field really digging in, the business is booming, and I have to connect that to the fact they did not have to deal with the hurricanes.
Yeah, if you ain't got to clean up, you have time to work on the stuff that pushes you forward, right?
Yeah, because Jonathan Foray, the often mentioned friend of the show, we have to, like, just sit down and just chit chat with him one time next time.
Yeah, we
need
to bring him on one day for sure. He'd love that.
he does have a beautiful radio voice and a beautiful television face. He's a wonderful man. But he talks about how we're just so tired down here, like that just rebuilding can wear you down. And maybe some of that prosperity from the 70s was enabled because they didn't have to pause to put everything on hold for a few years to rebuild their lives after hurricanes. And again, this is like regionally specific for us. This is just Terrebonne and Lafourche. You know, there are places where hurricanes hit horribly in the 70s, but the way that it happened locally is while we were experiencing this boom, the hurricanes decided to chill out. But the first hurricane I remember is Juan.
Yeah, same. Of course, that's the one. 1985. We were 4 years old. I think you were. I was. Yeah.
In 85, I was five. I was born in 1980. But I think I was about to start kindergarten. It was another late season. So October 27th, I'd started kindergarten. That's why I couldn't read. They pulled us out of school. I started kindergarten September of 1985 at Holy Rosary.
It was a category one. So yeah, that's what everybody says. It was a relatively like low wind hurricane, 85 mile per hour sustained, highest winds. My dad always, every time Hurricane Juan's mentioned, he mentions the water. He said he was on the phone with his dad.
Yeah, y'all aren't inside a lock system yet. That Morganza to the Gulf was going to put y'all inside of a lock system, but y'all aren't inside of a lock system.
Yeah, none of that lock system existed yet, yeah. So my dad called my papa, and he was like, I've never seen the tide come up like this before. And my dad couldn't start his old car at the time. He said something, but the water ended up staying for days. He ended up getting it started and moved farther in than where it was higher, but the water stayed for days, he said. And after it went down, I remember one of the first memories I have of any kind of hurricane, the Red Cross truck would come at the time and bring milk and sandwiches. And I'd go on the gravel road in front of the house once it was able to pass there and get sandwiches from the, because I just thought it was so cool that they would bring sandwiches to your house, you know?
Not like we had an ice cream truck, right? Like we had a sandwich truck? No, this is cool.
The Red Cross sandwich truck. And it was on Driftwood Drive, aptly named, you know? It would flood even without hurricanes, you know, just like a disturbance in the Gulf. I'd be taking the pirogue to the bus stop in the morning, but...
Yeah. See, for us, the reason the flooding was so bad, the flooding was horrible here. Like, everyone in Lower Lafourche had wainscoting after Andrew. Mm-hmm. Now, we're in our lock system, and the levees were fine, except some couillon, who shall remain nameless, but he knows who he is, he moved away, blew up the levee to save his cows. Oh, like, this SOB dynamited the levee because his cows were going to drown because the water came up so hard and so fast, and there are people that would pasture their cows on the outside of the levee. So he blew the levee up. Like, that's one of the reasons that we had that so much water. Thing. Yeah, it's a real thing. And I'm like, what did he do? And Mom goes, he moved away fast, because people were out to kill him.
What year was that? When was that?
That was 1985. That was for Juan.
Oh, that was for Juan? Okay.
That was for Juan. Like your daddy talked about the water coming up. Well, it was coming up here, too, because it hit. The way that it hit, it was just pushing the water up. It was pushing the water up. Mom said it looked like it was going to overtop the locks in Golden Meadow. And this guy, his cows, he had pastured them on the other side of the levee. So, pagow, he blew the levee to save his cows and flooded the whole of Bayou Lafourche.
That's some villain story stuff right there. Jeez.
My mama said if he would have stayed, he would have been murdered. Like, he just left. He left his cows that he saved, and he just got the fuck out because people would have killed him. My memories of Hurricane Juan are, because of the locks, we don't flood the same way a lot of other parts of the Gulf Coast can. But I remember that was the first time we ever had to use a pirogue. Like, we basically made like a little pull ferry between the houses for the kids in the neighborhood to be able to go from house to house and not worry about the snakes and the fire ants and stuff. We made a little rope pull pirogue thing between the houses, so you could go to Mama's house and you could get in the pirogue and you could go across the yard because the water was so deep. It didn't get in the houses where we were because we're right up on the bayou, so we're pretty high. But the further back you go towards the 40-acre canal, most people that were even a quarter mile back from the bayou had water halfway up their walls. Like, you'll see with 3 to 4 feet of flooding was pretty standard across most of Bayou Lafourche.
Where I'm from in Cocodrie, a lot of the camps and houses at that time, mostly, they're 7-8 feet off the ground or higher. You know?
And that was kind of one of the things, is because we have the locks, we don't have to build our houses that way, except for some moron with some dynamite. So, you know, Hurricane Juan, I remember thinking, oh, these hurricane things aren't bad. This is kind of fun. I got taken out of school. I get to ride in a pirogue. like my memories of Hurricane Juan
right, yeah, same.
Were more fun than anything else. And we definitely didn't evacuate. And we didn't evacuate for Andrew either.
We went up to buy it for Andrew, almost a home for Andrew.
Do you remember the old tracking maps they used to have? And I remember the last time we used it was for Andrew.
Oh,
with the
yeah,
magnets, the yellow one.
I didn't have a magnetic one. I just had the one that you'd mark the X's when, you know, as it moved.
My grandparents had one that was like a magnet board, and it was a map, and you get the coordinates from the radio, and you put the little red magnet where the hurricane was going.
Oh, cool.
We still have it at our camp. I'm going to see if I can get a picture to put up on the website, but it's just this, it's how they used to track when it was just the radio, right? You didn't have TV during the storm. So you get the coordinates and you'd put it on the map to see if you could track the storm kind of yourself when Nash Roberts was, had finally gone off. Yeah. He was the meteorologist back in the day. Yeah. He was nuts.
Yeah. Everybody either loved or hated Nash. I remember Nash.
Depending on the day of the week.
Yeah. Only to be replaced by Bob Breck. Yeah.
So Andrew was the first one where, like, because Andrew was a Category 5.
It was big. It hit Florida and then us.
That was the first hurricane that I was old enough to, like, watch the Weather Channel.
Yeah. We were 11 and 12.
Yeah, I was 12.
Yeah, I was
12. I think I had just turned 12. Yeah, because I was going to be going to, I was going to be going to public school, and I did not want this hurricane screwing me up. But that was, like, you know, you're 12. I was 12. You were old enough to, like, actually watch it and, like, see how scary it looked on television. Andrew, I remember being afraid.
Right. Well, yeah, that's one thing my mom said when I was talking to her. She remembers the news sounding super grim about the fate of Homa, like everything's going to be destroyed.
Yeah, because it hit, I mean, it hit the Bahamas, it hit Florida, it hit Homestead, Florida, which I remember, I just remember the coverage that we, I mean, we all know where it just looks
the
like.
The aerial coverage, yeah.
Where it's just debris, right? We you see, it's the same type of debris you see after tornadoes and stuff, where it's just, it looks like somebody emptied their closet and stomped on it.
Right. I remember like seeing entire houses just obliterated for that one in Florida.
Now, it was a Category 3 when it hit, and it hit closer to Morgan City. So we were on the east side of the storm, and it had gotten a lot smaller. But I remember Andrew is the first hurricane that I have like clear memories of.
Did it affect y'all a whole lot?
No, it just, it affected us. There was definitely some damage. Our house was fine.
It brought a ton of mud up for us. Like, it stunk so bad. It was mud from the marsh, and, like, it was all under the house. I remember having to push shovels of that stuff out into, like, the gravel road in front of the house just to get it out of under our house because it was just so stinky. And there was no electricity. It was hot. Pretty much nobody was around unless you lived there, and that was pretty rural. But, yeah, dude, even that was one of horrible memory. Actually, our dog got hit by a car down there, and yeah, we couldn't get to a vet and much less contact the vet, and Dad had to put our dog down kind of on the spot right after we came back from evacuation. Yeah, shoveling all this mud, it was like so sad. But
all of that sounds horrible. Like,
more people had worse, even, you know, I always think
I know, but a driveway full of boo pooty is still pretty nasty.
Yeah, in 1992. Yeah.
Boupouri means rotten mud for anybody who doesn't speak French. It's it's the, if you've watched what's the Dirty Jobs guy, Mike Rowe,
when he gets in the
dirt in the swamp with the alligator hunter, he goes, why does it tingle? It's because he's into Boupouri.
It's the
layer of rotten vegetative matter that does not make foufolé. We figured that out, but sits just as a gross sludgy layer over what passes for river bottom down here. I don't remember Andrew being that bad here. I know there were places that got it hit harder, but Andrew, I just remember being scary at the time, right? I remember sitting on the back porch and the sky, the color was wrong because we stayed at our house. My grandparents came to our house for that storm. I had a very little brother and sister, so they came to our house, Mama and Papa from next door. And my Aunt Viola, who was terrified of hurricanes, she always had to be in the room with no windows. Like, she just
everybody has that aunt, I feel like.
Pauvre Aunt Viola. But you know, we cleaned up, we cleared the yard, we had replace a few tacks, replace some shingles. Some places got it worse, but Andrew didn't have a devastating hit here. It was more just kind of for us, it was, I feel like it was kind of a reminder, like, don't let your guard down. It's been a while since y'all got hit, but like, hey, you know, keep your ears up.
Juan being the one before that was like 7 years before that. And before that, Camille, 69. So like, yeah, that's a huge spread. Andrew was kind of like a cautionary tale, maybe.
this is just for us. This is our area. You know, there
right,
the,
yeah,
the
yeah.
places where Andrew did hit were utterly devastating, and those people's stories are going to be more heartbreaking. You know, every single storm hits communities differently as it meanders through. Because for me, after Andrew, it was kind of another 70s, like kind of nothing till Katrina.
Yeah. Well, Hurricane George hit in 98.
Well, I wasn't in the area for those times, so I don't really have any personal stories. No, I was living in North Louisiana.
So that one wasn't too bad for us. That was in 1998, so I was like a junior in high school, so I somewhat remember it. But like nothing really happened. We had some wind, but it was all coming from the north. So my parents sent us to our aunt's house a little further up the bayou, but they stayed down the bayou at the camp, which was the house at that time in Cocodrie, because we lived there until I was 17. So we were about to move from there after this. But anyway, Hurricane George, 98. My papa called my dad and said, you know, the wind's coming from the north, the storm, we're not going to get hit too bad, but I heard they're catching boxes of shrimp running out of Robinson Canal at Terry Laperouse. So my dad, we had a popier net on the dock, so they'd back, and they dropped the net all night.
I love that, by the way.
He caught 900 pounds of 3135 that night. That Hurricane George. You're right. Just at the house, just with the, you know, because the tide was running right.
Okay, so a popiad, if somebody needs an idea, if you've ever seen a shrimp boat, mm-hmm. a popiad is just the big net that hangs from the, like yeah. a shrimp. So y'all just like a giant freaking scoop net, basically.
Yeah, we had one, and you just drop it off the edge of the wharf. We had a electric winch that my dad hooked up with it.
Yeah.
And you could pull it up and put it back down and just catch, if the tide was going right, you know, you catch yeah. the shrimp. And then I lived next door to my dad's cousin's seafood shop. Not shop. She just, like, bought shrimp. Then they'd send it off to plants. But anyway.
A shrimp shed.
Shrimp dock. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
So I'd sell it right next door. So it was a pretty good little operation we had for my high school years right there to be able to work from home.
There are people who live in landlocked states. And I've seen our analytics. Either everyone's using a VPN in HOMA and we only have like 10 listeners and they all live in South Louisiana, or there are people listening from across the country. But I feel like the idea of just being able to be like opening a net in your front yard and catching, yeah. what was it, 900?
900 pounds of shrimp, that 3135 to pound. So, you know.
That's some good stew shrimp. That's some,
yeah.
you know, that's not some 10-15s, but
that's
like
some nice ones, though. Yeah,
that's some nice ones. I could make a lot of shrimp spaghetti with that. Just, Lord yeah. have mercy.
Yeah, they both told me the same story independently too. I called my mom and dad separately, and they both had that same story. My mom thought it was 800 pounds. My dad said 900 pounds. That's the only differentiation.
We could call it 850 and be
850 pounds of 3135.
If it was half of that, that's still a lot.
Yeah. I'd often wow. catch like 100 or 200 pounds just in a good moon tide yeah. running, you know, just
that's
in my backyard.
Crazy.
Yeah, it was cool. Looking back, I was like, oh, man, I wish I had that.
The
now.
Hurricane George was shrimp. Hurricane George.
Yeah,
was
the shrimp.
The shrimp.
Yeah, I'm
hurricane.
Sure somebody caught Hurricane George pretty bad, but we didn't. I'm we sorry. Sorry for y'all.
Come over. I'll make you a po' boy to make up for it.
Yeah. Yes.
But after George, was there anything else? Are we going up to the big K?
Ivan in 2004, but like
oh, that's
we evacuated Ivan. To Alexandria for that. I don't remember too much about that one.
Ivan was crazy because I was living in Appalachia at the time. Okay. I do have stories about Hurricane Ivan. I was living in Asheville, North Carolina, but Hurricane Ivan stayed together all the way up to North Carolina. Like it was kind of crazy because it is just a big thunderstorm on steroids, sometimes that system mm-hmm. will just kind of stay and push through inland, pretty
oh, yeah.
far inland. But I didn't think I had ever heard of a hurricane reaching Appalachia because
yeah,
there was a
impressive.
Town called Black Mountain. Well, I was working at a call center at the time, and people were joking. Like, there were some people who were from the Outer Banks, right? And while the Outer Banks, they deal with hurricanes as well. And so they were joking that, you know, some of my friends who were from the Outer Banks but had moved to the mountains were talking about how they'd never gotten hit from a hurricane, not from the ocean. And we were kind of joking about it at work. It was a thunderstorm, right? We weren't like battening down the hatches or anything, but there wound up being a number of fatalities because of the volume of rain that was still in the system. There was a landslide and this whole subdivision just fell off of the mountain in Black Mountain, North Carolina. So there were like, I think 20 or 30 deaths from Hurricane Ivan in North Carolina. Wow. But yeah, this whole subdivision, just there was a landslide in the middle of the night. This whole subdivision just like sloughed off the mountain from the storm. So like Hurricane Ivan had more fatalities in North Carolina than it did in any other point. I wound up moving back a couple of years later, but I wasn't in the area, and I didn't feel like anything terribly devastating hit the area in that amount of time when I was gone. Like if a hurricane was coming, I'd call and check on my mom and all, but you know, nobody was freaking out over any of the storms that came through in those years. And then came the big K.
Not until that one. Yeah.
Right after we met.
That's right.
I started back at Nichols in fall of 2005, and that was my first semester was the hurricane. Like, I had just met you guys, and then we didn't have school for a month.
Where were you when you first thought, hey, we better evacuate this thing?
I have the most boring Katrina story of anyone in the state. My husband and I were dating at the time, and I was living on my brother's couch because I had no money. So I would go up and stay in Prairieville on the weekends regularly.
Mm.
Like, that was just what I did. He'd come and pick me up Friday. I got out of class at, like, 10. So Paul would come pick me up, sometimes Thursday if the Friday class was canceled. But on Friday, I was just spending my weekends in Prairieville.
So you were already evacuated?
I was already evacuated. I was at a time in my life when I didn't have a lot of stuff. I literally woke up, what was it, like, the Saturday morning to, like, we got a category what going where?
Yeah. Right. That's the thing. That one formed so quickly. It was unreal. Like, we saw it. I called my parents. I think it was like Friday or Saturday. I was at a bar, actually, when I had Ricochet Billiards.
Like Saturday morning.
Yeah. Mike Owen. Yeah. Right. It was like, I think I called them Friday night and said, hey, this thing looks like it's going to get pretty bad. And they were like, what are you even talking about? And I just knew my dad had his boat to deal with and all that, the shrimp boat and all that to deal with at the time. He still owned it. My brother and my cousin, we all lived together in an apartment. And they were cutting pipe at Benoit Machine. I was like, hey, y'all saw this hurricane on the news? And they're like, no, what? One of them would tell their supervisor, and they were like, whatever, just keep cutting pipe. That's not coming this way. And it ended up being Hurricane Katrina. But that's kind of how that hurricane was. It seems like it makes a lot more sense in hindsight than it did in real time. Like, I feel like it was hard to evacuate Katrina for some reason.
It was hard to evacuate, but like my mama said, that was the first time they went north of La Rose. I was in Prairieville. The rest of my family was in Cutoff, like my mom and my three siblings. My brother George was in college at Nichols with us as well, but he was at my mom's house for the weekend. And I remember my mom didn't want to evacuate, and I was watching the news, and I was like, Mom, you need to, and she was maybe saying, oh, I don't want to bring Mama on. She's a home health nurse. She doesn't like leaving her patients, right? Anytime she leaves, she knows she's got some old school, die hard, coon ass patients who are not going to evacuate.
Yeah.
So she feels like she can't evacuate because she needs to be able to take care of them as quickly as possible once the storm passed. That was always her policy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got a little sister. She was in high school at the time. Well, my mama listens to my sister. So I got on the phone with my little sister. I said, I will tell Mama everything you've ever done in your life. You hear me? I will tell her, I will narc everything that I know that you have done if you don't turn on the waterworks and get her in the van. 45 minutes later, they were packed up and on the road.
Are you serious? So you made them dead evacuate. Serious. Oh, that's awesome.
And look, there was some dirt. I will not spread my sister's dirt out here. I know she doesn't listen to the show, but like, you know,
no,
maybe
yeah,
somebody she knows does.
We're not asking to spread your sister's
dirt. I had to threaten my sister with teenage narking.
That's amazing,
like,
though.
Get Mom in the car. And they wound up getting stuck in Contraflow. I think they wound up riding it out,
man.
With
the
Yeah.
The flow out of town was horrible. Just going west, like leaving Terrebonne, going toward Morgan City, that like it was at a standstill at some points.
Oh yeah, I watched it on the news, like because we were at my in-laws' house.
It was crazy. That was the worst I've ever seen, as far as
it was horrible. But even with that level of evacuation, it wasn't enough.
Yeah, it looked like the cars in The Walking Dead when like you know
yeah,
all the cars are
really
just
did.
Like at a standstill. Yeah, that's a dude. A freaking a lady had her little Pomeranian or some Yippie Pomeranian like on the side of the bridge or whatever, and it jumped off into the swamp. And
I'm sorry, I'm laughing.
I know, me too. It still seems surreal, I'm sure, for her. She was like panicked. She was like, what am I supposed to do? My dog just jumped off. I'm like, and then the, you know, of course, eventually the traffic starts again, and she's like, I don't know what happened, actually. I've thought about that before. I'm like, I wonder what that lady ever did. She had to just leave the dog because it's like 40, at least 40 feet down into the swamp, you know?
Sometimes Pomeranians make choices. I have watched Pomeranians do stupid things. Not that degree of stupid, but they are a very decisive little dog, and sometimes they have to suffer the consequences of their choices. So I feel like that Pomeranian is either, well, I mean, God, that was 20 years ago. That Pomeranian's dead, even if it
Either
had
way.
swam to survival. We'll pretend that Pomeranian found like a nice lady who didn't evacuate, and they kept together company, and they all survived, and then they lived happily ever after in the
A
marsh.
nice swamp lady.
Sure. I mean, I've known some nice swamp ladies.
Yeah, me
But
too.
the thing with Katrina is the storm was bad where we were in Prairieville. Trees fell, but it was probably some water oaks that needed to come down anyway. My husband's family are incredibly competent and own a lot of chainsaws, right? They're those guys. And so our recovery wasn't terrible. It took a while. There was some rebuilding, but where I was wasn't bad. I remember calling my mom when they got back because, of course, they came back as quickly as possible. I was like, Mom, I'm coming downtown. Don't you come down here. It's hot as hell and the mosquitoes are attacking us. Why would you want to come down here? I was like, to help you? I don't need your help. I'm fine. Okay. I was like, I will stay and help the people who are not telling me to leave them alone.
Prairieville's right out.
Oh, Prairieville's outside of Baton Rouge.
Yes, for those of you who don't know, I had to look it
Got
up
it.
actually because I forgot where
Sorry.
that was.
It's
No, it's okay.
Prairieville is now probably technically a suburb of Baton Rouge. But we got it, but it wasn't terrible. We didn't lose power for a really long amount of time. It was a relatively easy hurricane. But it was seeing what was happening after that was so devastating.
Aftermath of Katrina was really what was up.
I feel like the narrative has gotten lost, especially with what happened with New Orleans. And as much as I wanted to keep this about like our experiences, like we still experienced it, right? Like we still experienced the fallout of that. Katrina didn't mess up New Orleans. The infrastructure failure and the leadership of New Orleans failed. Like the storm didn't breach the levees. The storm didn't f up the pumps. There were human decisions that led to the devastation of New Orleans. And like, oh, Hurricane Katrina messed up New Orleans. I'm like, government messed up New Orleans after.
Yeah, it was a combination of all that, really. Yeah. It did bring water in too, though, right?
It brought water in, but the pumps, Nagin, who was they brought in this guy for to be the mayor at the time, who was big business, and that was his thing, is he was a business guy, and he made choices about how many people to leave in the city, how many people to man the pumps, which pumps to leave on. And so basically, they didn't have enough pumps running. So the pumps that were running failed. And so instead of having like all the pumps running full out, they had two pumps that failed. Those numbers are not exact. Like, but you get what I'm saying? Like, it should have been a different type of job. And they just made choices. While there are other contributing factors, that's kind of the lion's share of the absolute heartbreaking devastation of Hurricane Katrina, that the tragedy that is still painted around New Orleans. You drive down Elysian Fields and you still see those crosses with the numbers on them from the walkthrough. You
Oh,
know,
that's
it,
right. Yeah.
you remember the buses that were in the Nichols parking lot when we came back to school? Remember those?
No, I don't. I don't.
Really? Because we used to roll cigarettes for them. It was all the people that had stolen the public transit buses.
Oh, wow.
Some of y'all were out of school for a little bit longer. I just went back to school as soon as Nichols opened back up, but I know some people.
Oh, okay. Maybe I was out for a little bit longer because I know my parents didn't have electricity for a long time. Yeah, we were trying to, help all that out because we did have some damage for it, but not a whole lot. Mostly with us, like I was working in restaurants at the time and going to school, and most of it was like accommodating the outsiders trying to help New Orleans too, because there was a lot of influx of people, like both leaving New Orleans and people from out of state, out of the area, coming into Houma as a buffer zone, staying in there to go and help the people of New Orleans,
But there were all those big city transit buses from New Orleans that were parked in that south lot just next to Talbot, which is the art department building at Nichols, at Nichols State and Thibodaux. Basically, it was people in New Orleans who had stolen, well, I say stolen, commandeered. I like that word because they were getting people out. They just took the public transit buses, loaded them with as many people as possible, and drove, and a lot of them wound up getting directed to Nichols. I remember I would just go buy packets of Bugler because it was what I could afford, and I would just sit there and roll cigarettes and hand them out. There was this one woman I will never forget. We were sitting on the steps. It wasn't the steps of Talbot, but it might have been like, it was close by. Mm-hmm. Might have been the steps of Talbot. Anyway, and she did not know where her entire family was because she had sent her son and her grandchildren ahead of her into that Contraflow mess we were talking about earlier. Wow. She didn't even know if they'd gotten out of the city because they couldn't fit her in the car. So she sent everyone else ahead and she stayed in the city because she couldn't fit in the vehicle that they could use to get out. They didn't all have cell phones. This was before everybody had a smartphone.
That's important to know right now. You know, social media wasn't a thing, really.
Yeah, I got a Facebook account that year.
Right, yeah. But it wasn't widespread.
It was not widespread at all. The more affluent people had phones with media capabilities, but it definitely wasn't. If your phone had a camera, it was like, ooh. But she couldn't. She goes, I don't know where my grandbabies are. I don't know where my son is. My daughter was in New Orleans East, and she didn't evacuate. So this woman was just sitting there with utter devastation and no way to figure out where her entire family was. She was all by herself. And she wasn't the only one in that situation. And that was
so many people. Yeah. See, that does sound familiar to me. My wheels are really turning now because that whole situation.
Yeah, it was two or three, maybe as many as four, just New Orleans City Transit buses parked on the south parking lot outside of Talbot and Peltier and all. And these people were just, they looked like walking ghosts. They were just lost and desperate. You know, these were the people that hadn't evacuated. And mm-hmm. the stories that were coming out of New Orleans, I guess that's kind of like a lot of other subjects that we just brush on. There was at one point you were hearing about people taking over the bridge, the stuff in the Superdome. Those stories were so visceral and so excruciating. I feel like I got this weird get out of Katrina free card. You know, I feel guilty about how little Katrina wound up impacting not just our community, because again, the storm was strong, but a lot of the greatest devastation came from the New Orleans choices, right? The reason Katrina was such a devastation, Katrina could have been as, you know, a Hurricane Andrew here, but because mm-hmm. of what happened in New Orleans and that devastation, it just brought so much attention to the area. But the New Orleans stories are so gut-wrenching. And I'd like to possibly revisit that, you know, with somebody who's a little closer to the New Orleans culture going forward. Maybe next year for hurricane season, we can bring in people from outside of just you and I, outside of our native communities, and talk to them about their hurricane experiences. But Katrina just reshaped so much of the landscape.
What I do remember about Katrina is the rationing of things. It felt like very third world for a while. You had to stand in line to get gas at the gas station because people were filling generators and filling tanks to bring further east to New Orleans. Supplies like water were even kind of hard to get just because they were being reallocated elsewhere too. And we still were recovering a little bit ourselves, you know, so it was an interesting dichotomy of helping and trying to help yourself too at the same time.
Yeah, the Hurricane Katrina just was this weird bellwether. And I remember the next summer, it was so weird. There was a hurricane that never even got a name. It's a storm on record, but I don't remember exactly. It was like in September of the next year. And I was home visiting. My little brother was home with me. And we were in the living room, and it was literally like a hurricane that blew up and disappeared between Fouchon and Lockport.
Wow.
My mom was away. She would travel for medical conferences. And we were home with my stepdad. And mm-hmm. my stepdad was just, he kind of slept a lot. Like, he was kind of like having an old dog. Like, he just kind of stayed in the other room, and you knew he was alive, but you didn't interact with him much. And my brother and I were like, we're watching. She had one of those glass front doors, and we were watching it bow in and out. And we're like, I was like, Ethan, this thunderstorm feels strong. Turn on the radio. The only place we could find that was reporting on it was KLRZ, which is like the local radio mm-hmm. station out of La Rose. And they were taking call-in reports from Fouchon. He goes, the National Weather Service is not responding to us about the storm. They say it's negligible, but we're getting hurricane category one, sometimes two gusts coming out of Fouchon. And so sure enough, it was like a little category one that just kind of formed, blew up, blew over us, and blew away. And they can happen like that. They can happen so quickly and so small that you only lost a few shingles. We had to put rugs under the doors and windows and stuff to keep the water from blowing in through the window casings. Like it was a category one, but it was a category one that never got a name, never got recognized by the National Weather Service.
Interesting.
It was September the year after Katrina. It's not on record. There's no documentation of it really because the National Weather Service completely disregarded it. And it was kind of one of those things like the guy at KLRZ, the radio station guy, whoever was reporting that night at KLRZ was like pissed about it. It was an interesting evening of just me and my brother. And that felt to me kind of like Andrew. Katrina didn't feel like Andrew to me, but that night with that little bitty storm with my brother and I by ourselves, essentially alone in this old house and just sitting there and feeling the wood move around you being like, no, we're going to be okay. No, we're going to be okay. And then aftermath.
Yeah, no, I feel you. Before that, though, like, we got hit by Rita, too. Did y'all get affected by Rita at all? That was the same year as Katrina.
It was.
You remember that?
I forget about Rita. I've completely.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring attention back to that because that was a huge storm. Dude, Rita was 180 mile per hour winds. That is crazy. Category 5.
When did it hit?
It hit like 3 weeks after Katrina. It formed in September 18th, 05. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how devastating Katrina was, just so you know, that we don't remember Rita.
Rita hit going towards Lake Charles. And the only reason I'm remembering it is because I'm literally looking at...
Where did it make landfall? That's what I want to see.
That's what I'm looking up.
Oh, it did go a little west. Yeah, the only notes I have on that is that it hit, you know, relatively soon after, and we got a lot of water in the lower-lying parishes.
If the hurricane is east of us, then we get...
Mostly wind pushing out. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's one side is wind, one side is water.
If a hurricane falls to the west of you, think of it flowing counterclockwise, right? Like, it'll be pushing that water from the Gulf into the land is what it's doing if it's landing to the west of you.
Mm-hmm.
So you get wind and water. But yeah, if it lands to the east of you, then you typically only get wind that's sort of a little weaker because it's already blowing across all that land as well.
It's expended some of its force. It says it made landfall between Johnson Bayou and Sabine Pass. So yeah, gotcha. Like all the way almost on the Texas border. So I guess that's why we don't think of Rita is everybody was still kind of ronfled from Katrina. We're like, oh crap. So then that's one that hit Lake Charles, Poveda Lake Charles. I know that as we're kind of zeroing in on the big Ida, Lake Charles is still recovering from the hurricanes that hit them. Because Lake Charles got a double whammy like that not too long ago. It was Hurricane Laura and Delta were the two that hit Lake Charles. Laura was a Category 4, and that one really, really messed him up. And then when Delta came through, it was only a Category 2, but it followed like the exact same path. Mm-hmm. It was riding in its frickin' wake. A friend of mine from back in the day, I remember she was so sad. She had to walk, I think, 5 miles. From the perimeter to get to her house just to see that it had been destroyed. And then they had just started working on reconstruction. And then Delta came through and like, they were already just so down. But Hurricane Laura made landfall on August 26th. 8,000 homes were damaged. I think it hit like near a refinery. Some bridges took some severe damage because barges got unmoored. So it was one of those things that like it just completely jacked up the area. But I know that there are places there still to this day, so 4 years later, that still are blue tarped. You know, there are still places in Lake Charles that have not fully recovered from storms 4 years ago. And then we've got us, you know, then we've got a Hurricane Ida, the big bad, the one we're going to tell stories about for the rest of our lives, the way that our grandparents told stories about Betsy and Camille.
I watched Ida from on satellite from northern Michigan. Doing a fantasy football draft, fell on that day for some reason. But I was so upset that I felt for y'all and everybody else that had to go through it. My family was obviously down there for that. It was just, even from afar, it was the most gut-wrenching thing I felt in a long time.
I was not going to evacuate, except the summer before had been Hurricane Zeta. And Hurricane Zeta was going to be a Category 2. Oh, surprise, it's a Category 3. And we did not evacuate. And me and my kids were at my house. And the sky turned weird. And me and my kids were like, okay, we're going to go have story time in the hallway. And mommy was not panicking. And my husband was at work. Like, Zeta everybody just kind of carried on, and it just got a little bit of a bump right before it hit. You know, storm windows were up, but there wasn't a lot of evacuation for Zeta. But I'd never been through a hurricane with my kids before, and I got scared.
No bad.
So the next summer, I was like, okay, we rode through a Category 3. That was scary, but let's talk about it. And again, like I said, my mom is not known to evacuate. And she's not, my mom is like a warrior woman. You know, she's not somebody that I have to take care of. But I did not want to leave without her. And then I think it was like the Thursday before we realized that I wasn't evacuating because she didn't want to evacuate. And she wasn't evacuating because I didn't want to evacuate. And she didn't want to leave me with the kids by myself. So I'm like, we're both stupid. Where can we go? Like, we realized that we were staying for each other, and we both actually wanted to leave. So my mom is scarred for her life for the contraflow from Katrina. So she goes, we're going to go to Patsy's, which is my aunt in Metairie. So we evacuated to Metairie.
There you go.
Yeah. And I thought it was just going to be me and my mom and her boyfriend and my kids, but it wound up like my aunt kind of invited everyone. So it was like all of my cousins and some other cousins and a lady from across the street that we didn't know who she was before the storm. And then she was kind of our cousin by the end of the day. I remember when the storm really, really hit that night, I was terrified because I was literally watching live streams on YouTube from my friends. And I have a friend I call Castnet Renata, and Castnet Renata has never evacuated. And Castnet Renata was evacuating. Shout out Renata in Golden Meadow. I love you, girl. She's my friend from like middle school. Like we known each other for a minute. My husband had to stay because he worked at the hospital, and that was the evacuation point. So he had to stay. And his, like he said, I have to be at work on Monday, whether we have a Category 1 or a Category 5. So I'm just going to stay to make sure I can be here for cleanup as soon as possible. So he was in the hospital, and the last word we got from them was the video of the roof blowing off the hospital.
Yeah.
And then I did not get in touch with my husband for 2 days.
Yeah, that's scary.
So I looked at it this way. We still had some lines of communication, occasionally text. Like some information was flowing, and we didn't hear about any fatalities.
Yeah.
So I knew nobody was dead, right?
Right.
And so I just kind of had to take comfort in that. Me and the kids were like up on the levee trying to get signal because my aunt lives near the lake in New Orleans. We stayed in New Orleans for about a week. I think it was the Tuesday after my mom and her boyfriend were able to get through with their medical passes. And they wound up coming back up to New Orleans with my husband. And it was excruciating. He was so tired.
Bad.
He was just so tired because he'd been working. Sometimes a hurricane comes and you're off work. Sometimes hurricane comes and you have double shifts all the time. And my husband was definitely in a field where it was double shifts all the time. It took about a week to sort out the kids because basically once Dutchtown, which is south of Prairieville, like near New Orleans, once they got power back, I was able to bring my kids to my in-laws and just kind of be like, hi, they're living with you for a minute. We got to go do shit. And like, I came back down here. And my kids were there for about two, almost 3 months.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was November before my kids moved home, like right before Halloween.
Yeah, that's huge. That's insane. Yeah, my parents stayed for it, too, and they stayed in Berg for it, which my dad's been reinforcing that house for a long time. It's made with steel beams that were part of the reason he bought that house, to be able to, you know, revamp it and be able to make it last, you know. Anyway, but my mom was like, oh, my God. It was only a night, but it seemed, you know, it only lasted an evening, but it seemed like it was forever. But like, even like you said, after, like, I didn't know, I had no communication with them, you know, being this far
God,
away.
I can't imagine.
But then I heard from her 2 days later, you know, she drove to like West, like to Lafayette or something, just to have cell phone signal to call, to let us know she was okay, you know?
Yeah. I remember I felt really bad because I made a joke that the hurricane slowed down in Golden Meadow so it wouldn't get a speeding ticket.
Oh, my God.
And then it did. Like, it was only moving like 20 miles an hour because we never got the eye. Like, that was one of the worst things. That's one of the reasons why Lafourche was so messed up.
Yeah.
A lot of the houses that were destroyed, it wasn't even necessarily that the house... Now, some houses definitely blew apart. But it was that the winds were sustained for so long that the houses just blew off the pilings. You know, you talked about y'all houses being elevated.
Yeah.
Well, because so many of our houses are just on that cement piers block, they just blew off.
Yeah.
They just blew
the house
off
I grew
of their
up
foundations.
In is gone because of that. I don't know if it was wind or water. I don't know what the conclusion was on that. But yeah, it's gone. The house we evacuated from so many times till I was 17 years old. We'd have been wise to evacuate it for Ida because that's the one that took it, right?
when I came back down, I came in on 90 with a car full of dehumidifiers, contractor bags. I don't like cleaning. I had a whole nervous breakdown because I was in a parking lot in Prairieville, and I was talking to a good friend of mine who got me through the storm. Like, she stayed home from work. She lives up in Arkansas. She stayed home from work to Google things and text them back to the people who are in the Orleans area, because we couldn't access the internet. Like, we couldn't access information, but we could get text messages intermittently. Right, yeah. That was like the only way to get.
I remember that, actually. My mom would text me to ask me what the weather was going to look like the next few days and stuff like that. Yeah.
My kids had to learn what VHS cassettes and DVDs were. Like, right, we didn't have internet until almost Christmas. We got power back right before Halloween, because that was when we brought the kids home. But we couldn't communicate. You know, my mom was trying to coordinate all this medical stuff for clients, and it was like people could not grasp how cut off we were after the storm. We had to go to Lafayette to get supplies. The first thing when I came back down was the boats. And that freaked me out when I came back.
What you mean, the boats? Like all the boats that are flipped over and like blown?
There were boats where there shouldn't have been boats. There were boats on the side of the road. There were boats on the road. There was a big trawler right next to the bridge just north of the Intracoastal. Like, if you imagine coming down 308, there were boats everywhere, upside down in the bayou, in the middle of the highway, run up on ground of the bridge, you know, driving down the bayou. The bayou was clogged with completely destroyed boats that had flipped, that had sunk, that had been thrown against each other and destroyed.
Yeah. That brings me to a story, actually, about a man who stayed on his boat. And I don't know if you read that article? I think it might have been in the Homo Courier or something like that. A man who we used to shrimp and trawl with when I was a kid, actually, for a long time. He stayed in his boat with two other guys during Ida. Somehow the boat capsized, flipped it over. They had to get out before they drowned, like clawed their way to this shed that was still up. I don't know how they could even see. I know he said something about crab cages were just flying by their heads like they were.
Oh my God.
I don't know. It's just crazy to even imagine like the intensity that they must have faced just to. Everybody thought he was dead. You know, nobody knew where he was until they saw somebody came back and saw him on the side of the road. And yeah, he told them that story. And that's just wild, though.
It just doesn't stop. Like, I remember my mom said, we're going to get Samson to take pictures in the eye, but the eye never came. And so I think that's one of the things, is that the eye was literally between what's Terrebonne Bay is on the backside of Golden Meadow. Mm-hmm. The eye was that close. So that eye wall was right there, but it was on the other side of the levee. So we were in the eye wall for hours and hours and hours and hours.
So both our parishes basically got the eye wall just on different sides.
Just on opposite sides.
Y'all were on the slightly, y'all were on the more intense side, I'm guessing.
You know, when I came back down, it was just one of those pull on your big girl panties and get done. We didn't have the option of not doing it. So after Ida, everyone else in my family was working at the hospital, right? They didn't get any time off. My mom was seeing patients. My stepdad was working to reconstruct. My husband was going into clean. So they would leave at 7. And my mom was kind of running the home health agency at first out of the kitchen counter, but then they eventually got office space. And I just came to my house, and my house was, my roof blew off. Everything was wet. There was mold growing that looked like some sort of art project. And you just did what you had to do. My mama must have personally picked up, when I tell you, a levee of shingles from every street, like everybody's roof blew in my mama's yard as far as she's concerned. The stacks of shingles, Jonas, like there was a 6 foot tall, 40 foot long levee of house shingles in front of my mama's house before they started picking up the debris. I am not exaggerating. No. It was just because all the other houses just came through. We lost trees. We lost, you know, my house is still messed up. We are sitting here in July of 2024 and my house is not done.
3 years,
you know,
later,
even people who are able to get contractors through the Restore Project, as much of a mess as that is, a lot of people's houses are still not done. I have friends who've just moved home like this year from having their houses being fixed from the storm. The hospital, They just had the groundbreaking ceremony for the replacement hospital yesterday.
Wow.
Shout out Billy Nungesser. We love you, Billy Nungesser. You're good for the arts in our state. He came down and did the groundbreaking at Lady of the Sea. My daughter jokes all the time that how are we going to navigate once they get the houses right? It's like this used to be there, like buildings that were there my whole life. Grand Isle, even more so. Oh my God, how our camp survived is proof that we just built up some good vibes in that. Because like, I think it was something like a third of the buildings were destroyed on Grand Isle. It was so much for Grand Isle. It devastated Grand Isle so, so badly. Our camp is over near what used to be called the front bar. They had the front bar that was on the beach, and they had the back bar that was by the shrimp shed. My landmarks, you know, you get used to coming back off the beach, and you go over the levee, and you see where you're at. Uh-huh. My landmarks for that were wrong. So the first time I went to the beach after the storm, I thought I was in the wrong place because the buildings that I used to navigate by were gone. So it's been transformative. It's been devastating. A lot of people are displaced. A friend of the family was a school bus driver, and she used to stop at an apartment complex she'd pick up 30 kids, and that apartment complex blew apart. You know, they lost so much population to our schools. They were able to consolidate whole schools together because they lost so many students from people having to leave.
Are they still in like portable buildings and stuff? I know a lot of schools in Terrebonne Parish were in portable buildings for a long time because the schools themselves are inoperable.
There were so many people displaced, they didn't necessarily need the temporary buildings. They consolidated two or three middle schools into one middle school. It wasn't a blessing, but there was enough population loss that there wasn't a need for the capacity of the temporary buildings. Gotcha. I know South Lafourche, because it's the only high school, South Lafourche has some temporary building situation. And that poor dude, shout out senior class of 2024, because those kids, hokey pokey, their freshman year was the pandemic.
Yeah.
They came back for Ida. They had to do all kinds of stuff on the field because the gymnasium was destroyed. So like they had prom on the field. They had homecoming on the football field. They went to have senior night. The lights exploded and caught on fire. Like they just handed out the first football for senior night. And the lights in the stadium caught fire. So it had to shut down. Like the kids that graduated class of 2024 from South Lafourche High School are either like, those are some of the most amazing trooper little teenagers. I know quite a few of them. Those are some amazing kids because they have rolled with some hella devastating punches for the last 4 years. And they made it through. I mean, 2020 was their freshman year and this was their senior year. Like that's a horrible 4 year chunk to try and also be a high school student in.
Well, congratulations on your perseverance, guys and gals. Yeah, good for you.
Oh my God. Those kids just went through some, you know, living in campers with their families, having to come down here and everybody pitching in. But I think coming back to, you know, what we talked about, this has come up a lot, is that it's the perseverance of these coastal communities are what keep us coming back. You know, yes, Ida was horrible. But you know what? The day that everything went wrong and me and my mama lost both refrigerators and both deep freezes, even though they were running on the generator, we lost both of them in a 24-hour period. We had a blast that night. No. Listening to classic rock on the radio and eating with everyone in the neighborhood. You know, we fried so much food because we lost all the freezers. What do?
You got to eat
cook
it
everything
now,
up and you start hollering at the neighbors because you don't have cell service. Hey, Noble, hey, Joyce, if y'all want to see, we got some food going on. Our freezers went out. You know, like they show up because they know that's what happens. You get together and you help your neighbors and you help your people around you and you just do what you have to do. And I think that that's one of the things that, yes, those hurricanes are devastating and I think they do wear us down. I don't know if I have another Ida in me. It takes
I've
over
heard
your
that
whole
from
life.
Multiple people for sure.
I mean, I'm sure your parents have to have a line. I know your family's as dug in Terrebonne as mine is Lafourche, but
yeah.
You know, we definitely had that conversation this year of like, okay, if we get locked out, how much insurance money are we going to have to play with and where are we going?
Yeah.
And I haven't had that conversation seriously before the way I've had it this year. This is the first year that thunderstorms don't scare me. I used to love listening to thunderstorms on the roof. And the last 2 years, I'm like, when it starts raining, I get nervous.
Because
we found out that our roofers were scam artists who stole their credentials, so we don't have any sort of insurance on our shiny new roof, and we don't really know what quality it was. it's difficult living down here. I'll still take a hurricane over any other natural disaster. You know, if you die in a hurricane, you made a choice. You had That's 2 weeks warning. You know, it's not like back in the day where you didn't know.
Hopefully you had 2 weeks warning. Yeah, sometimes. Well, I mean, yeah. You have,
at the very least, 4 days.
Yeah,
right?
4 days, yeah. But that's the thing with, like, with Katrina, when we were talking about that, you had, like, 2 days before you knew, you know?
2 days is more than you get for a forest fire or a tornado.
You're right.
But
yeah.
I was talking to a friend about tornadoes, though. It said, you know, if you get hit by a tornado, everything's gone. If you get hit by a hurricane, there's this expectation of rebuilding. And yeah, I think it reshapes your life. How many projects did I have on my plate that I was ready to tackle the world? Because that was when the world was just opening up after the pandemic.
Right.
You know, there are people that were in different areas and different places in their life that they were able to catch that sort of post-COVID economic boom,
mm-hmm.
you know, artists and other people in the creative industry, that they were able to catch that wind in their sails and go on to prosperity, whereas we were devastated. We had just come out of the pandemic. It put a lot of things in perspective. I'm grateful my house still stood. I'm grateful we had the, you know, insurance coverage that allowed us to make the repairs that we have. I'm grateful to have a partner who, kids out there, don't, you know, I always tell people who want to learn how to draw, if you ever plan on having a partner that you might have to remodel a house with, learning to draw can save your marriage, regardless of any amount of professional aspirations to be an artist. Like, if you can just draw a shelf and show mm-hmm. your person who knows how to do the woodworking in the house that's how you want it to look, it can save your marriage up one side and down the other. That my husband has not murdered me and thrown me in the bayou is uh-huh. proof of his patience in the last few years, because we had an unexpected full house remodel that we're doing at a lot of DIY because there was only so much money. And oh my God, all the prices went up after Ida. It's so weird. But it does. It wears you down. But I think that's when being Cajun, and I think that's when being from down here, you know, in the Couillon episode, we said you can't be Funchak after a hurricane. You know, you have to be willing to get down and dirty with your neighbors to come back from that. And it builds the community. But especially for people down here, we're just tired. We're a little exhausted from the world, so that now when the hurricane comes, I don't know, it feels like we don't have as much spring in our step a lot of days. It's rough. It's really rough. I don't know if you see that with your family that's still down there, but I know in Lafourche, it's just been a long couple of years.
Oh, for sure. Especially, you know, the closer you get to, you know, the storms, you know, the farther back you go, the worse, obviously. Now it's, you know, they're getting better, obviously, but still, people down there are still living in response to that hurricane in many ways, you know.
It's come to shape our entire way of life down here. We brought up Jonathan before in this mm-hmm. episode, but Jonathan really talks about how the people of the lower parishes, the people of the coastal parishes, that one of the reasons that we haven't done the jobs of coastal restoration, of saving our culture, of learning our French, and of preserving our culture the way it is because we spend so much of our life just dealing with these storms and just dealing with the reality of living in a place that's washing into the Gulf. That there is only so much existential dread in any one person. And when you throw these hurricane disasters on top of it, it just takes you even further down the hole, you know, that there's only so much resilience in any community. And our constant resilience has just been tested profoundly. And we keep trying to bounce back, but like anything that bounces, eventually the bounce kind of goes out of the ball. And I'm hoping that our area can catch a break. Maybe we won't have any more hurricanes for the next couple of years. Maybe we can catch a break.
Yeah,
and I have hope. A 1970s. Maybe we can have a decade of
prosperity. Yeah,
where the hurricanes kind of stay at bay. I know too much about environmental science to think that that's probable, because as the Gulf gets warmer earlier, those storms keep a coming and they don't stop coming.
And they're going to hit somebody, you know?
Yeah.
Whether it's you or your neighbor or 300 miles down the coast and, you know, somewhere else. It's got to land somewhere.
But I try to stay hopeful, and I have faith in my great-grandfather's carpenter and the years of sediment under my house that hold it slightly, very, very slightly, above sea level. You know, I just kind of have faith in my neighbors. I have faith in my family.
Is that going to be it? Is that the future for the South coast of Louisiana to just keep moving slightly farther north. I know, you know, the house that we lost for Ida was where I grew up, like I mentioned, until I was 17. Then we moved further inland 15 minutes, and then my parents moved further inland 15 minutes from there to something that's probably 14 feet over sea level now, you know, like, which
That's
still is
high.
not that hard. That's high for down there, yeah, but like.
I was talking to a friend of mine a couple of months ago, and we were talking about land loss, coastal erosion loss, and everything. And we were equating it to coal country in Appalachia. And I said, you know, when coal was done with those small towns in Appalachia, the mountain was still there. And I don't worry about Cajun culture, right? The fact that you go towards Lafayette, you go towards the Prairie Cajuns, Cajun culture as a entity is going to last. It's going to outlast you and me and everybody else who's alive right now listening to it. I don't worry about that. It's just knowing that our little slices of it, that our little pieces of coastal Cajun culture are going to have to adjust as the hurricanes keep coming and the land keeps washing away. You know me, I hate living on a down note. Like, I'm okay with that. I think one thing that Hurricane Ida has made me make my peace with is, you know what? You know where we went after Ida? We went to Lafayette because that was the closest place you could get supplies. And I remember sitting downtown, and I was with a very, very good friend of mine, and he gave us a place to stay. And he wound up going out with his dad, and he's a single dad. His kitchen was a mess, and I cleaned his kitchen, and I felt so grateful to have a mess that I could tackle and that I could quantify. And that I could resolve in like 2 hours to just clean this kitchen top to bottom, spick and span. And I had to apologize to him after because I was like, don't be offended. You know, if somebody comes to your house and you clean their house for them, some people would take offense. I was like, don't. I said, this was the best favor. Your dirty kitchen was the best thing in my life right now because it was something I could handle. It was something I could fix. And I needed that. So don't be haunted that I cleaned your kitchen, but I cleaned your kitchen. And I think that we can take that into a metaphor. I think that the greater parts of Cajun culture will always be there to welcome us as we need to evacuate, as we need to leave. You know, we're not on our own in a hurricane. We're not on our own alone in these storms. We have that larger community. We have that larger Cajun spirit. We have that larger sense of family across the south of the state because we've all caught it. You know, Lake Charles has caught it, Lafayette has caught it, Abbeville's caught it, Morgan City's caught it. So we know. And we know how to take care of each other. And I kind of have faith that we are always going to take care of each other in that capacity.
Mon Dieu, we're gonna have to rely on the Cajuns north of I-10, but that's okay.
As long as they keep the tomatoes out of the gumbo, I'm fine with
That's
that.
right.
All right, guys, I'm going to go and put up some storm windows now just because of all this reminiscings has got me a little bit paranoid. As always, if you want to know more about our resources, now you can't just roll up at my mama's house and ask her all her stories about Hurricane Betsy, but you can go to outlandishparish.com. You can look in the show notes for links to most of our resources, especially 64 parishes. It used to be called Louisiana Cultural Vistas. But 64 parishes, I promise I've probably used one of their articles in every single episode of this show. So go ahead and check out the show notes if you want to know anything more. There's so much history, so many dates, and every area's experience is different. If you are looking to support us to help Jonas with what he's doing with Creatures of Conquest or to help me in my new path as a tattoo artist, you can find us at our websites, creaturesofconquest.com or alexisbro.com. You can find us on social media. You can find the parishioners on Facebook. We have a group there. You can also find us on Instagram at Outlandish Parish and, of course, at outlandishparish.com. So go ahead and give us a like and follow. More than anything, if you like what we're doing here, if you like the voices that we are sending up the Big Muddy and out into the world from down here, if you're here for the accents, if you're here for the stories, if you're just here to learn more about our culture, go ahead and give us a share and help keep this train where the trains don't go, keep on a chuggin'. Bien merci, and I'll see you all soon in Outlandish Parish.